You are a bold and courageous person, afraid of nothing. High on a hilltop near your home, there stands a dilapidated old mansion. Some say the place is haunted, but you don't believe in such myths. One dark and stormy night, a light appears in the topmost window in the tower of the old house. You decide to investigate, and you never return.
We didn't scare you too much. That's the classic opening track of Disney's 1964 record, Chilling, Thrilling Sounds of the Haunted House. Coming up later in the show, KCRW music librarian Eric J. Lawrence will introduce us to some Halloween music you have probably never heard before. But first, it is looking pretty good for Republicans in next Tuesday's election. Experts aren't debating whether the GOP will take over the Senate, just by how much. Molly Ball is The Atlantic's political reporter. Welcome back, Molly.
Hi, Madeline.
So it does seem pretty likely that the Republicans will take over the Senate. How many are locked in now? How many seats?
Well, there are still 10 races that are pretty up in the air, some more than others, but there are about 10 races that we are watching. Of those, Republicans need to win five to take the Senate, because they're already thought to have three locked up, but then there are two Republican seats, Republican-held seats that are in play on top of eight Democratic-held seats. And so of those 10, Republicans need five, and they lead consistently in the polls in seven. So without a major upset in several races, Democrats are going to have a hard time overcoming the trend that we're seeing in the polls.
Okay, so we're looking at perhaps seven. And what do you think is on the Republican agenda? Are they already talking about the agenda now as if they've already won?
They are. And of course, you've got to take anything that candidates say on the campaign trail with a grain of salt, because of course they're going to say whatever voters want to hear and promise the moon and say that everything is going to be hunky-dory. But, you know, I wrote recently about this sort of paradox embedded in the Republicans' campaign rhetoric, because I noticed that when I was listening to Republican candidates out on the trail, there were seemingly two contradictory messages side by side. On the one hand, they are saying, vote for us, we will stop Obama, right? We will put an end to the Obama agenda, and this election is a referendum on the president who you don't like, so vote for me, and I will make sure that the president's agenda stops right here. On the other hand, they're saying, vote for Senate Republicans, we will stop the gridlock. We will get Washington working again. We will get things done. Democrats have been in the majority. We need change to end the status quo of gridlock, and so the change is going to be you elect us. Well, you can't end gridlock in Washington unless you work with the president. Now, Obama is not going anywhere in this election. He's not on the ballot. And so unless Republicans are willing to work with Obama rather than just say no to him, there's not going to be an end to the gridlock. So I've been trying to puzzle out how could they do both of those things, and talking to candidates and talking to senators about how that would work.
Yeah. And so do they have an idea of how that would work? Are there some issues where there is some wiggle room, or are we just going to see two more years of this gridlock before the next presidential election?
Certainly, the status quo is always a good bet in Washington, and there are a lot of pessimists who think that not much would really change. I mean, just on paper, we have divided government now. We will have divided government after the election. Bipartisanship has not exactly been in fashion in Washington over the past 6 years. So unless, you know, a bunch of policymakers suddenly wake up on a different side of the bed, that's probably the best bet. On the other hand, there are some specific areas where there is not so much partisan disagreement, and where some of the disagreement does just come down to partisanship and each side not willing to give the other a win. In the past, both parties have expressed an interest in things like immigration reform, tax reform, entitlement reform, or budget that combines solving long-term entitlement problems with cleaning up the tax code, that kind of thing. Energy, criminal justice, these are some areas where there might actually be a constructive path forward. And I think it's just as important to remember that Republicans will have an incentive to try to get these things done when and if they take sole ownership of the Congress. Right now, Democrats have one House, Republicans have the other, so they can each point the finger at the other when nothing gets done. And if anything did get done, neither would necessarily get the credit. If right. Republicans own Congress, they get all the credit or all the blame for anything that Congress manages to do. Plus, they know that in a national election, a presidential election, they still have an image problem. They still have a demographic problem. They need to prove to the American people that they can govern if they want their candidate to get elected in 2016. So that also, a lot of Republicans, a lot of pragmatic Republicans behind the scene, people like Senator Rob Portman, who I talked to recently, are urging the party to put forward that positive agenda.
Well, you mentioned Rob Portman, and you note in your piece that he voted against the immigration bill, the bipartisan immigration reform bill that eventually passed the Senate. So if it already has passed a Senate that is not controlled by Republicans, what makes it likely that this immigration bill would actually get through when you have a House and a Senate controlled by Republicans?
Well, you point to a very important factor here, which is not the Senate, but the House. And in a lot of ways, Republicans are their own biggest obstacle. Even if pragmatists like Rob Portman want to get something done, there is still the House Republican caucus to contend with. And immigration reform is one of a number of pieces of bipartisan legislation that the Senate has been able to get through that the House has not shown any willingness to pass. And John Boehner has had a hard time controlling his restive conservative flank. That caucus has had a lot of conflict within it, and there are going to be still more conservatives in the larger Republican House majority that comes back next year. But, you know, the House Republicans have as much as said the reason we don't want to do immigration reform is not because we're against the policy, but just because of who's the president. Because we don't trust him to enforce the law is their excuse. But really what they're saying is we want to do this, but we don't want to give Obama a win. The question is, when Republicans control Congress, will they be motivated to do something that many of them want to do, although there's division in the party, given that they can then sort of take sole ownership of it?
Well, it's really fascinating that Obama is not on the ballot this year, and yet he is in very many instances.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a factor more than anything of just the terrain on which this campaign is being waged, because so many of the seats that are up are Democratic-held seats in red states. So, you know, it's very easy if you're a Republican in Arkansas to say, my opponent's a Democrat, the president's a Democrat. You know, he lost this state by 23 points in 2012. So, you know, if the same people come out and vote the same way this year, it's an easy path for the Republican candidate, Tom Cotton. But, you know, Obama's popularity has plummeted so far that we're seeing him even not welcome in states that he won easily twice, like Colorado and Iowa and New Hampshire. Those are three states where Democrats are unexpectedly vulnerable, and a lot of it has to do with the way the president is dragging down Democrats this year.
Molly Ball, always a great discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic. And now a story about the rich versus the super rich. It's about the future of the Santa Monica Airport. There are two competing measures on Tuesday's ballot. People who live in the wealthy neighborhood around the airport have been agitating for years to shut it down. But the city's hands have been tied by an agreement with the Federal Aviation Administration to keep the airport open. But that agreement runs out in July of next year. And so that brings us to next week's election. A pilots group, which is supported by really rich people who have their own private planes, put a measure on the ballot that would prevent the city council from deciding the airport's fate. Dave Simpson is a reporter for the Santa Monica Daily Press. He's been following this pretty complicated story. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
All right. So tell us more about this measure. It's called Measure D. What would it do?
Sure. So Measure D effectively takes control out of city council's hands and puts a lot of the control over the future of the airport or land use decisions about the airport into the hands of the voters.
So not the voters on Tuesday, but at a future date after
July. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So if this measure passes, anything that city council would want to do, many significant changes at the airport would then have to go to a future vote in front of the whole public, as opposed to just an ordinance that city council could pass with, you know, four council members in theory.
So then the city council puts another measure on Tuesday's ballot. It's called LC. And what would that do?
So LC, it doesn't do a whole lot in terms of restricting the council's ability to close the airport. They maintain their ability that if they make it through lawsuits with the FAA and are able to at some point close parts of the airport, that would be a decision they can make rather than having to put it before the public. But once that section is closed, let's say that happens, there would have to be a public vote on the land use for that area. So that area couldn't be developed in theory until a public vote decides, hey, we only want buildings that are this tall, or we only want arts districts, or we only want a park, et cetera. That would be something that would go before the public.
Well, still, the pilots groups, the people who own these private jets, are pretty scared, it seems, that the city council is moving in the direction of shutting down the airport.
Definitely, definitely. They've kind of jumped on some of the anti-development fervor that's going on in the city right now, and they're sort of tying the two issues together, and they're spending lots and lots of money to try to, cede some of council's control over the airport.
So they're basically saying, if you vote for this, then this parcel of land, the airport, will be turned into a big development and cause more traffic.
Absolutely. Right. The whole debate has sort of, I think, the way I've seen it is the Measure D folks have really kind of tried to shift the debate away from the airport itself and said, hey, this is a land use issue involving, once this airport's gone, you're going to see towers there and there's going to be more traffic, et cetera, et cetera. And even the measure itself, it comes on the heels of a big referendum. There was a big referendum about development that required lots of signatures, and effectively the residents overturned this big development through signatures. And very soon after that happened, these airport people, the aviation folks, introduced this ballot measure that is about the airport but was sort of framed as a development issue, and I think a lot of people didn't recognize the difference between those two initiatives.
So is this airport used by anyone else, anyone who doesn't have private planes?
Sure. So there's, the actual aviation portion of the airport is used by flight schools. So those are kind of prop planes that you'll hear flying around, in circles throughout the day. There's mechanics who work on the airport. There's just kind of hobbyist people. I've gotten a lot of calls from people who say, hey, I'm just someone who owns, a small prop plane. This is my passion. And, this is what I like to do with my money. This is kind of like all I have with that. But there's a lot of people, who own private jets and are flying in for the tech industry here, or celebrities, people like that as well.
Right. And so, and also, I guess, the pilots groups, this is backed by a pilots association in Washington, D.C., right?
Right.
And is there a lot of money being poured into this?
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, there's basically two big pilots groups. There's one in Washington, D.C., the NBAA, and there's another one in Maryland. That's AOPA, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. There you go. And they combined have put about more than half a million dollars into this. I think they've each put around $250,000 as of the last filing that I've seen of the $800,000 or more that's been put into this already.
And who's behind the other one, LC?
LC, as I've seen, you go down the list, and it's largely residents of Santa Monica giving, $100, $200, $300 donations. That's if you were just to look at, each contributor, there's a lot of people giving kind of smaller donations there. There was very early on, I don't know if it was poorly timed. It didn't seem like it was a smart move in terms of a political sense, but there was a developer who gave a $10,000 contribution early, and that made it look bad, and the Measure D people jumped on that. But since then, we've seen a lot of, contributions from within the city of Santa Monica itself, specifically from the area around the airport.
Meanwhile, what does the FAA have to say about all this?
Right. So the FAA doesn't talk about anything on the record, but it seems as though in the future they're going to litigate whatever happens. If Measure D passes, it'll make it harder for city council to move in the direction of closing parts of the airport. If Measure LC passes, their hands will be a little less tied, but most likely, and our city attorney has said as much, almost whatever they do, if it involves restricting aviation at the airport, there's going to be lawsuits that take a long time to sort out. So, this is really very early still in the process of actually slowing aviation at the airport.
So it could take years and years before it shuts down, if it shuts down.
Right.
Dave Simpson, reporter for the Santa Monica Daily Press. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Coming up, it's Halloween, and so it's our opportunity to play some truly dreadful music from Bach to David Byrne. We'll have a short history of some scary songs next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. I hope you're going to have a great Halloween tonight. And when you think about Halloween music, one song jumps to mind immediately, right? The Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
All right. And also you have Michael Jackson's Thriller. But the world of Halloween music is a lot bigger than you might think. KCRW music librarian Eric J. Lawrence is here to broaden our creepy musical horizons. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay, so yeah, we have the Monster Mash, but you want to start way back with classical music.
Yeah, so, you know, Halloween is a holiday, a traditional holiday, especially in the U.S. It's actually fairly recent, the sort of notions of trick-or-treating and dressing up. That's all wasn't codified until sort of the early part of the 20th century, but horror themes in music have been around since the beginning of music. There was a notion of the tritone, which is a particular interval in music that they refer to as the devil's interval because it had a certain kind of discord to it. And a lot of the church music that was being written, they discouraged the composers from using this particular device in the music. But it was very popular for later composers because it did give a sense of sort of unease. It was even reported to sort of induce nausea in the listeners. But whether it was actual technical music like that or just thematic things, such as in famous works like Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain, Saint-Saëns' Dance Macabre, they oftentimes used sort of the imagery of the Witch's Sabbath to be sort of a backdrop for kind of the dark music that they would provide. And some of it kind of came later, the after effects of it. And one great example would be Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, which has been used in many horror films through the years, but probably best sort of known as kind of the classic Phantom of the Opera theme.
Now, of course, we automatically think creepy, but did he intend it that way, Bach?
I'm not sure that he necessarily intended that way. He meant probably more just sort of deep feeling.
Yeah.
But it was used in the 1932 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as kind of the opening theme. As I mentioned, it wasn't used for the original Phantom of the Opera with Lon Chaney. That was a silent movie, although many of the organists that would accompany it might have chosen to use that particular piece, but it was sort of used officially for one of the later sound versions of the Phantom of the Opera as well. So it just very quickly became associated in the cinematic world as being kind of the definitive. If you got a creepy guy sitting behind an organ, that's the song he's playing.
Exactly, with a candle dripping with wax,
right.
Candelabra dripping with wax. All right, the Jazz Age, moving on, had its own Halloween-themed music.
Yeah, well, you know, once we got into a lot of pop music, vocal music, they used those themes quite frequently. They used them and tend to use them in kind of a punning way where they would say, you know, oh, I'm bewitched by your lovely appearance, or, you know, I'm haunted by your love, that kind of a thing. But sometimes they'd be a little more explicit in the subject matter they were doing. Louis Armstrong had a song called The Skeleton in the Closet. One of my favorites from that time period was from Bing Crosby. He was used by Disney in their animated version of The Tale of the Headless Horseman, The Adventures of Ichabod Crane. And in his narration for that, they also then break into a song called The Headless Horseman that he does in the film. It was later done in a recording from K-Star, and that's one of my favorites from that era.
When the spooks have a midnight jamboree, they break it up with a fiendish glee.
ghosts are bad, but the one that's cursed is the headless horseman. He's the worst.
When he goes jogging across the land, holding his noggin right in his hand, demons take one look and groan.
Then they hit the road for parts unknown.
Well, there's no.
So that's not really scary. It's more jaunty.
It is. It, like I say, at this point, they're sort of using it more of a spirit of fun than anything really genuinely scary.
Okay, so then rock and roll comes around in the 50s, and then this is when we get into the Monster Mash mania.
Right, exactly. And I sort of attribute it, a lot of it happened to be kind of an interesting synchronicity. In the late 50s, when rock and roll was kind of hitting its stride, it also happened to be the same time that a lot of the movie studios were sort of offering up their films that had been in their libraries for the past few decades to television. And for a lot of people, this was sort of their first opportunity to see some of these classic 30s golden age horror films, such as the Boris Karloff Frankenstein and Bela Lugosi Dracula. And that sort of served as great inspiration, I think, for the younger generation to sort of incorporate those characters and those kinds of macabre themes into some of the songs that were coming up. It was a very popular thing for, you know, a rockabilly artist to write about, you know, a vampire or a wolfman,
Wolfman Jack.
And Wolfman Jack, obviously, that, you know, and it was throughout pop culture these things would appear. For example, on television, this is when you had, you know, shows like The Addams Family and The Munsters were starting to come about, and cartoons, even, I'm sure you recall, the breakfast cereals with Count Chocula
and
Frankenberry and Booberry. So there was this definitely a monster mania going on. The Monster Mash is certainly the most popular and well-known. There was also sort of a subset of these that were called death discs. And these would be songs that dealt with kind of really morbid themes about people dying. Probably the most famous of them is The Leader of the Pack from the Shangri-Las, mm-hmm. where it was about a motorcycle gang leader who, in the end of the song, sort of dies in an accident. There was sort of a parody of that song done in the UK. The version was done by a band called the Downliner Sect called I Want My Baby Back. And it was sort of told from the perspective of the auto that got into the accident with the motorcycle guy. And in the course of that accident, the guy's girlfriend who was in the car with him dies as well. And he's so distraught by this that he just can't live his life. So he ends up digging up her grave and opening up the casket, and, well, you might imagine.
It's been many months now since that fatal night. You know something? I've tried. Believe me, I have tried. But I just can't make it without my baby. And I've decided I'm gonna have her back one way or another. Oh, baby, I dig you so much. Hog dang Peter!
Guessing this was not a top 40 hit?
It was actually not a top 40 hit, but it was a minor hit in the UK.
Okay, moving into the 60s and the 1970s when we get a lot of darker rock and roll, or at least flamboyantly dark rock and roll.
Right. So, you know, the songs that we've heard so far have all been kind of, even if they've been a little bit gross, they're sort of in a spirit of fun. A lot of the rockers that were coming out of the 60s, and as music was sort of getting progressively a little more complicated and ornate and more adult, maybe, a lot of the musicians were wanting to sort of shy away from the kind of hippie peace and love sort of notion and wanted to get into some really sort of more darker themes. One of the ways they would do this would just sort of claim that they were into Satanism and that they were sort of participating in various occult rituals. Some of the bands that were sort of probably best known for this type of thing were bands like, you know, maybe Black Sabbath. But one band that actually had a fair amount of success with it was a band called Black Widow. And their debut album was called Sacrifice, and it included a track that they claimed was using some of the language that actually would be used in a black mass. It was a song called Come to the Sabbath. And with a perspective of 40 years on, it sounds still pretty ridiculous, all things told. But, you know, that's what they claim.
Secret oils, perfume herbs will heal your sores. Join me in my search for power. Wives and husbands, bring your kin. We'll be as one within the hour. Let the Sabbath now begin.
Come to the Sabbath, come to the Sabbath, Satan's there. Come, come, come to the Sabbath, come to the Sabbath, Satan's there.
Okay, all I can think of is Spinal Tap. That's all I can think of.
I would not be surprised if they took great inspiration from Black Widow's early records, yeah.
Yeah, the dwarves around,
yes,
the,
exactly,
the four-inch-high,
yeah,
Stonehenge.
You know, some, like I say, from the perspective of time, it sounds just too much like, you know, Jethro Tull just having,
yeah,
a time with the fairies, but... you know, at the time, it was regarded as pretty risque, pretty out there, and they continued the sort of black magic theme for another album or two, and then they finally gave it up and moved on to something else.
All right. Some serious musicians, Brian Eno and David Byrne, make your list as well.
That's right. They had an album called My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, which was really unique and kind of an important record. It was one of the first records to use sampling to represent kind of the vocal portions of the record. So they had built up this sort of funky... polyrhythmic sort of music that went with it, but they used a lot of found recordings to provide the more lyrical content. In many cases, this was found material from the radio. They used some ethnographic records, and on one particular track, they used a recording of a reported exorcism. They call this track the Jezebel Spirit.
Jezebel!
Legitimately creepy.
You know, you think about it, you know, the beginning of the song is mostly instrumental and you're sort of bobbing your head and dancing around, and all of a sudden you're starting to hear these messages and it's like, wait a minute, yeah, this is a little weird.
A little weird. It's okay. So anyone making this kind of music today, any legit Halloween music?
You know, certainly horror themes have existed in pop music over the past 30, 40 years. You know, there's goth rock, there's the black metal scene that's very popular in Scandinavia. But there's also been sort of revivals of this kind of more innocent monster mash, monster mania kind of fandom. And some of them do it really quite well. One of my favorites comes from an artist named Kid Congo Powers. He actually worked with Nick Cave for many years. He himself, somebody that has some sort of dark themes in his music. But Kid Congo's latest project is a band called Kid Congo and the Pink Monkey Birds. And they had a record from last year called Haunted Head. And the first track off the record is a song called Lurch. And it still has that kind of garage rock feel to it, and they have this chant, this incantation in the song, talking about ghostly whispers and following the bells and stuff like that. That's one of my current favorites.
Follow the bells. Follow the bells. Crazy yarns spun us dizzy. Lucha via. Shiny secret. Ghostly whisper, fever blister.
Kid Congo doing Lurch. Eric J. Lawrence, it's been so much fun. Thanks for getting our Halloween off to a great start.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Eric J. Lawrence is KCRW's music librarian. And we would love to hear from you. What's your favorite creepy Halloween song? Call us and sing us a few lines, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up on the program, The Nightcrawler, a new spooky movie with Jake Gyllenhaal, comes out today. We'll have a review of that and some other movies in our regular Friday film segment. That's after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, you know, it's Halloween weekend. Not a lot of candy at the box office. But if you're headed to the theater this weekend, maybe to avoid all of the people in their sexy carrot or zombie Waldo costumes, we've got your movie guide right here. Kyle Buchanan is senior editor at New York Magazine. Welcome back.
Boo.
Ooh, I'm scared. And Christian Horloff, co-host of the Schmoes No Movie Show and contributor to AMC Movie News. Welcome back.
Thank you. I guess I can just go, does that work? Or does it sound like I'm clearing my throat?
Yeah, not so scary. Sorry. Okay, well, let's talk about something that is scary. Nightcrawler, Jake Gyllenhaal stars as a man who finds his calling as a crime scene videographer.
We find our viewers are more interested in urban crime creeping into the suburbs. What that means is a victim, or victims, preferably well-off and white, injured at the hands of the poor or a minority.
Just crime?
No. Accidents play. Cars, buses, trains, planes, fires.
A bloody.
Well, graphic. The best and clearest way that I can phrase it to you, Lou, to capture the spirit of what we air, is think of our newscast as a screaming woman running down the street with her throat cut.
I understand.
Okay, Jake Gyllenhaal there with Rene Russo as a news director. And what is this about, Christian?
Everything that you just heard there, it's like a satire almost on just the culture today and the way that we perceive news. And I watch the local news sometimes with my wife, and that clip alone, that's all you see. It really, for the majority of it, except with sports and weather, and that's all you see. And they play on this. And what Jake Gyllenhaal is basically what they say from Nightcrawler. He's a guy hard in the job market, can't find a job. And grabs a camera, starts filming stuff late at night, and he is void of emotion, Jake Gyllenhaal, in this film. He is not a human being, and he is absolutely, he's going to be nominated for the Oscar for sure on this one.
And Kyle, you interviewed him, and he lost something like 20 pounds or something for this?
He went above and beyond. He lost 20 pounds. He injured his hand punching a mirror at one point, a bit of performance improv, and he's terrific in this role. Yeah. I kind of think that we've been sleeping on Jake Gyllenhaal for the last few years. Notice I said on, not with. Dirty KCRW audience, get your mind out of the gutters. He's been doing great work in this series of smaller dramas lately, like
Enemy.
Prisoners, Enemy, yep. End of Watch. And he probably, this is a career-high performance for him. He's incredibly compelling. It's not the easiest character to embrace, but he sort of proves the maxim that a character doesn't have to be sympathetic to be fascinating.
So he's an anti-hero.
Gyllenhaal's not. Gyllenhaal is an opportunist, and it really is that it's the story of just get it done however you can get it done. He's a single guy. He's on his own. He's creating a business, and the way he does it are ways that are going to make you squirm as an audience, for sure.
You know, let me say, we might be sort of making this movie sound unenticing, and I want to say this is actually a very darkly funny movie, too.
That's why I said
satire,
absolutely.
Cracked up watching it. Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of my personal favorite movies of the year. I would highly recommend that people go out and see it. I can't put it any better than to say, I see so many films for my job, and you just get into the sort of like numbing routine of knowing exactly where the movie's going to go in the first 20 from the first 20 mm-hmm. minutes. And Nightcrawler kept surprising me. I had stunned laughter throughout.
I agree, and it's in my top 5 for the year as well. And it is absolutely suspenseful. The way that this movie paints L.A. in this dark, gritty, reminded me kind of Michael Mann's Collateral as well, mm-hmm. too, in the way that it paints L.A. And you just, especially if you live here, you're like, oh, I know that street. Maybe I don't want to go down that street at this point, but the way it is. It's painted in such a way.
So it becomes a character.
It absolutely becomes a character. And the way that just it's intense. And Rene Russo should be mentioned as well.
She's
too,
great in
she
it.
Is so, she is.
And where has she been lately?
She was in, I think, Thor recently. She's been in a couple of.
Yes, not to any great effect. She had mostly taken time off. And she had just sort of lost her passion for doing this. But actually, Dan Gilroy, who wrote and directed this film, it's his directorial debut. He's married to Rene Russo.
Ah.
And he wrote her a phenomenal role that I think could get her some awards contention.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, on to another movie, maybe not as award bait worthy. Horns, starring Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter, and I guess it's a horror comedy mystery mashup.
What are they?
You know how I think we should proceed? I should grind me up some OxyContin and have a little snort.
Well, everyone in this town is going crazy. I think it's because of me and these horns.
You killed that innocent girl, now the devil has claimed you.
He didn't kill her father, and now people are telling me all these things I don't want to hear.
No. Oh. Kyle, what is this movie about?
So Daniel Radcliffe has been accused of killing his girlfriend. He doesn't really remember what happened because he got blackout drunk. And what starts to happen is he grows these gigantic horns on his head.
As one does.
As one does. And they have the interesting supernatural power of making people confess truths, their deepest desires, their dark secrets to him.
Huh.
And he starts to realize that he can use these unsightly things to sort of manipulate people to give up clues that could help him solve the murder.
Okay, and
you know what? You know
what else is in this movie? Is there a kitchen sink?
It's exactly that problem with this movie. I mean, Daniel Radcliffe does perfectly fine work, but this is a movie that isn't content to just rest on that premise, which is a whole lot to swallow on its own. It keeps introducing more powers, more rules. At a certain point, the audience is like, okay, I'm willing to go with you. Introduce the world. Tell me what the rules are. But if you're in, you know, the second half of the movie and you're continuing to introduce those new rules, people get restless. They want to watch the things they already know play out. You know, you've got a juicy premise. Let's see it exhausted before you move on to the next thing, if you move on to the next thing at all. You know, you've only got 90 minutes to 2 hours to tell these stories.
And how is Daniel Radcliffe? Has he shed his Harry Potter skin?
I just want to see him do some more outside, bigger. I do want to see bigger budget movies from him and bigger scale films to see what he can do next. I'd like to see him pop up in like a Star Wars film or something along those lines to see. He's a very talented dude.
He's had a good run in indies as of late. He was really good in Kill Your Darlings last year. And he's got a lot of personality. I think that's actually what's going to save him, because Harry Potter, as iconic as that role was not necessarily, you know, this character role bursting with quirks. But then when you see Daniel Radcliffe on Jimmy Fallon, you know, rapping this incredible Black Alicia song, you think, okay, this is a guy who has, you know, magic powers that we haven't even seen on screen yet. So I think there's a place for Daniel Radcliffe.
Okay. Big news in the superhero genre this week, which might be just the movie genre, right? I mean, we have so many superhero movies out these days. Yeah. Marvel unveiled their 5-year plan earlier this week. And 5-year plan, really?
I thought it was genius. The way that they did it, Marvel had this special kind of email that goes out that invites press and fans. And it's like this, it was almost like a Comic-Con event, what they did at the El Capitan in Hollywood. And Kevin Feige, president of Marvel, who is genius in the way that he is a fan as well, introduces what's coming out. And they set it up and get you excited, because this is like, it's no different than like a television show with one continuous storyline with a bunch of seasons that's going to further the plot. It's very exciting the way that they did it, with announcing characters and storylines. And even bringing out some of the actors, it was really a
it's
fun.
It's like
event.
An Apple event, right?
It was.
The latest
he's their Steve Jobs. He really is. Kevin
Feige had that kind of fervor for sure. And I think what's also notable about the announcements they made is Marvel had sort of gotten dinged for its lack of diversity in their superheroes. You know, this is a movie universe that's dominated by blonde actors named Chris.
Yeah.
And finally, with the release of their 5-year plan, they announced Black Panther, one of the sort of biggest black superheroes in the comic book world. Mm-hmm. He'll be played by Chadwick Boseman, who was so great in the James Brown biopic Get On Up earlier this year. And they also announced a movie called Captain Marvel. That's going to be a female-led superhero film.
So we're going to be seeing superhero movies from here on out to the rest of our lives. We're going to be watching
at least until 2020. I mean, right? Between Marvel and DC, you've got about 4 to 5 coming out a year.
Wow. A year.
Yeah, and Fox and Sony.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's tons. You know, it might seem like overload, and it very well may seem like that even more over the next few years. I'll give Marvel this, though. Even though these movies all share an interconnected cinematic universe, they feel different in a genre way. Mm-hmm. You know, Captain America the Winter Soldier, which came out this year, feels like a different movie than
like
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if they can continue to differentiate those films from one another while also leaving the room to pull them all together for these Avengers mega movies, then perhaps these comic book universes can continue to sustain themselves.
Especially in Marvel, and I agree with Kyle, because Marvel is very aware of that very thing. They know that they have to up it with the spy thriller and then the space opera, and then from what Ant-Man could possibly maybe say it's like a heist movie or something. They're going to keep changing it up to make you feel like, if you're not a fan of what's going on in the Marvel Universe, but you like spy thrillers or you like, you know, space operas, you're going to have that. These are not just comic book movies. They're good films.
I want one with horns. Just saying. Is that possible?
I don't know how this one's going to do.
If they're going to exhaust every opportunity, you'll get your horns movie soon, I'm sure.
Okay. All right. Christian Harloff, co-host of the Schmoes Know Movie Show and contributor to AMC Movie News, and Kyle Buchanan, senior editor with New York Magazine. So, Warren, you just heard our two critics raving about Nightcrawler, and on your program you have the
We are going director. To be talking with Dan Gilroy, who is the writer-director of Nightcrawler, and has some very interesting things to say about the film, which, as a former television person myself, I can tell you is a very interesting film.
In the Howard Beale mode?
Not quite. It's a little darker than that, to say the least.
Really? Darker than Network?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So that is coming up on To the Point.
And we'll also talk about big pressure being applied to the American Red Cross over various revelations of both documents and insider interviews about how it was really more concerned about public relations than it was about public relief after Hurricanes Isaac in Louisiana and Sandy in New York. I should say Louisiana and Mississippi. And Sandy in New York and New Jersey. Very scary stuff, really, when you consider that disasters will occur in the future.
Absolutely. Okay, two must-listen-to pieces coming up at 1 o'clock on To the Point. Thank you very much, Warren Olney, and happy Halloween
there.
To you.
Same to you.
Thank you.
Ooh.
All right, and coming up on this program, a young woman with an inoperable brain tumor gave tomorrow as the day she might end her life. We'll talk about her advocacy for the Right to Die movement next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play from KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
So the worst thing that could happen to me is that I wait too long because I'm trying to seize each day, but that I somehow have my autonomy taken away from me by my disease because of the nature of my cancer.
That's 29-year-old Brittany Maynard talking in a recent video about her terminal cancer diagnosis. Earlier this month, she announced on YouTube that she had moved from California to Oregon to live in a right-to-die state. Her first video has more than 9 million views. Her story has flooded the media and reignited the debate around euthanasia. We're joined now by Arthur Kaplan. He's the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, Brittany Maynard originally said that tomorrow would be the day when she would end her life. Now she's saying she doesn't know, but tomorrow will not be the day, but she doesn't know when that day will come, but it will come. Can you give us a brief overview of her case?
So she's 29, newlywed, from California, diagnosed a few months ago with a terrible, incurable brain tumor. It's the sort of tumor that eats into the thermostat of your brain. It's going to affect your ability to breathe, to balance, to digest food slowly, cause her epilepsy, cause her tremors, probably cause a lot of pain. It's in the cerebellum. It's called a glioblastoma. It's nasty. So she got this information. She talked about it with her new husband, family, and said, I don't want to go that way. I don't want to go through that long, torturous decline. You can't legally help me die here in California, but in Oregon, and by the way, in Washington and Vermont, it is legal for a doctor to write a prescription, and I could take those pills myself, and I'm going to move there, and that is what I'm going to do.
And why is her case getting so much attention? She has been on all the networks. She was on the cover of People magazine.
You know, I hate to put it this way, but it's because she's vivacious, 29, a newlywed. Most of the debate about right to die, when you think about these issues or managing your dying, it's older people.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who are, you know, kind of toward the last innings of the game. But she's not. And so I actually don't think she raises all that many novel questions, although there is one we can come back to in a second. But She doesn't raise all that many novel questions, pro or con, about the merits of physician-assisted dying. What she does do is she shifts the optics. Now we've got a whole new generation paying attention, younger people, people who changed laws about gay marriage, people who changed laws about marijuana. And I think opponents of any change toward legalization are nervous that she's pulling in a whole new set of folks who have succeeded in changing policy.
Well, interesting. Has she then ignited a grassroots movement or some kind of political movement?
Yeah, great question. There are and have been grassroots movements around. There's a group called Compassionate Dying that's been around forever. There are groups like the Hemlock Society. There are some physician groups, nurses who favor trying to expand this. And then there are many religious groups, disability groups, some other physician groups who don't. I don't know that she has added much to the membership roles. Let's put it that way. I do think she's been successful in gaining people's attention. We'll have to see whether gifts and contributions go up as a result of her public call to support legalization as part of how she dies.
And there's not only a debate about euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, but there's also a debate going on in this country about how people die and whether or not our system should be focused more on palliative and hospice care.
So the two are interconnected. If you have good palliative care, meaning pain control, if you have good hospice care, people sort of getting emotional support as well as pain control in the final days or weeks of their life, it certainly is likely to diminish any demand for assistance in dying, for getting pills and wanting to take them. So one public policy challenge is, before moving to legalize physician-assisted suicide or assistance in dying, it is important to make sure that hospice is an option, that palliative care is aggressively being provided. I don't think that's true for all Americans right now. It is a problem in terms of the political arguments, because you don't want people saying, well, I have to end my life because I'm going to get rotten palliative care. That's the wrong motive. So that has to be there. And proponents and opponents of it, of legalization of assisted suicide, I think could agree we need to have a right to hospice and a right to palliative care for everyone.
And right now, why don't we have that?
Some of it's money. People who don't have insurance obviously had their problems getting access. Some of it's resources. Not every part of California will have a hospice. Some of it is training. Not every hospital has a palliative care person or has trained people well in pain control. So some of it's availability, some of it's insurance.
But in Brittany Maynard's case, and maybe in many other cases, she's talking about that she doesn't want to decline whether or not there is hospice care available or palliative care available. She doesn't want to lose control of her body, and this is really about control and when she decides the end is here.
And I sympathize with that. I used to be a critic of assisted suicide. I've switched my position. I worried about abuses, that poor people would be rushed off, that people might say, you know, hey, Dad, you're using up the tuition money here, so why don't you leave us now? That hasn't happened in Oregon and Washington, the states with the long experience. I think then you start to say, well, if someone doesn't want to go that way and they do want to take pills and hasten their death and they're terminally ill anyway, shouldn't they be allowed that choice? If there's not going to be abuses and the laws in Washington and Oregon appear to have worked, there haven't been abuses, it's kind of hard to see what the counterargument is.
Arthur Kaplan, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Arthur Kaplan is head of the Medical Ethics Division at New York University Langone Medical Center. Jolie Myers is here now. Happy Halloween to you.
Well, happy Halloween to you too,
Thank
Madeline.
You.
I'm not a big Halloween person unless it involves candy. and then, you know, every day's Halloween for me.
Exactly. Why stop on just one day?
You know, so we celebrated the holiday by spinning some spooky tunes with Eric J. Lawrence, and we wanted to hear about your favorite creepy songs. We got a couple Thriller nominations, clearly. That video terrified me when I was a little kid. My sister used to put it on our record player just to freak me out when I was a tiny person. But it has nothing on the video for Portishead's Machine Gun. I don't know if you're familiar with Portishead.
Well,
it's got
I love
a trip
Portishead.
Hop. Very creepy atmospheric stuff. Yeah. So I see where that is. But someone mashed up that song with a Japanese horror movie from the 80s. And the movie involves a creepy skin condition that causes people to turn into octopus monsters. And I know that it sounds cheesy, but with this song, it turns really creepy. I was watching it in the control room a few minutes ago, like, ugh. So I tweeted a link out a few minutes ago if you guys want to check that out. But I think that one wins. That was Riva Erdos tweeted me and nominated that song.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Jolie Myers. Again, have a great night tonight. You too, everyone. Have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.